I'm Dan, I'm an addict. That part was true. Can y'all hear? All right. I've been to a lot of these that I couldn't hear well. I'm scared. My friend told me to do it scared. I replied, that's probably going to be the option we're working with tonight. Totally blank. I live in the Piedmont area. Since I guess everyone does this, Piedmont area of Narcotics Anonymous, my home group is called Off the Tracks. We meet 5 days a week, 7 p.m. I moved there recently, about 5 months ago, and I gotta say this, my previous area was the Peninsula area of Narcotics Anonymous, and my home group there was called Never Alone, which is the theme this year, and has been an important thing for me in my recovery. This is fucking weird. I need to put a timer on because I'll accidentally share forever if I don't do that. But I can't set it down anywhere. I don't know. I feel like naked. There's no, y'all can see my legs. Is there anyone who's at their first Brana right now? Awesome. Welcome. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here. And, you know, this kind of blows my mind that I'm having the opportunity to do this. And to be truthful with you, being able to come up here and share, it feels like one of the biggest honors that I've had in my lifetime. And I'm being serious. You know, I've been to Brana, I think, about 10 or 11 times in a row. I got clean in the southwest of Virginia. I moved to Western North Carolina, and after about 2 years, I came to Virginia in 2013, and there was sort of a question of, like, am I going to be able to make it? Can I be in a different state and recover in Narcotics Anonymous? I didn't know. I was coming up on 2 years clean. I had been going to meetings in one city, in Asheville. That's what I knew of Narcotics Anonymous. They taught me the how NA worked there. And I came to Virginia, and when I moved, everyone was talking about Brana. Brana, 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 Brana. They were announcing it and saying that I should go. And everyone was like, they were hyped up. And I mean, there's like, people in Peninsula area are fucking serious about coming to Brana. Yeah. And so they pulled me along, and I feel like it changed my life being here. You know, so this is important to me. And that's part of why I'm scared, is because I care about this. And it also sounds weird up here, so I can't tell. It's like, whew, sounds like the way I think. It's fucked up. It's like fishbowl. All I can hear is me. Oh, my God. I don't know what to talk about. Someone said, tell the truth. You know, you're like, all right, let's wrap this up here. The story of how I got asked to speak here. I got, you know, some sort of email about, you know, submit your tape. We need speakers to speak at Brana. And I was talking to a friend, and I was like, you know, that would be fun. But I don't see myself, you know, like sending it, hey, this is my tape, listen to it. And she was like, oh, well, I'll do it for you. And I was like, all right, bet, what's your email address? So I sent it to her, and she forwarded it on. And I got to continue pretending that I'm humble and all for the best, you know? So I'm really grateful and excited that I get to be here and that we are all here. And this whole thing is about we. You know, this whole thing is about doing together what we were not able to do alone. And the first word of every step in Narcotics Anonymous is we, except for step 12, having had. You know, we emphasize that here. And so, God, I'm going blank, y'all. This is hard. This is different, you know, being up here. I already said that this means a lot to me. And I had, you know, I've basically, Shaney called me a few months ago and asked me if I would do this. And I said I'd be honored to do it, of course. It was about 2 weeks after my father had died. and I had a whole lot of other stuff going on, and I said, I felt like if I'm not in a psychiatric ward, I will be there, you know, because I had a lot of stressors in my life, and I want to talk about that at some point. I have no sense of time right now. I do want to share about, you know, recovery and how I got clean and so on and so forth. Oh, that's right. I had a look, I have in my head shared to y'all like 600,759 times, and half the time y'all loved it and you kind of like venerated me as a god, and the other half of the time you fucking tarred and feathered me and humiliated me and I had to go home and cry and, you know. So I've done this a whole bunch of times, and then I'll continue doing it after I leave. I'll share again in my head. Because for me, in my world, and I think this is true of a lot of addicts, it the shit that goes on up here somehow seems a little bit more real than what's actually happening here in the world. And that's one of the problems I have. I never was part of a we growing up. Maybe I was and I didn't know it. Imagine the possibilities. And so I was thinking of this story that I was told about me when I was a little kid, that we went out, and I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. We went out to a Chinese restaurant, and we got fortune cookies at the end, and we all opened the fortune cookies, and I couldn't read at this point, you know. I don't know if I was exceptionally stupid, or I just don't think kids read at four. I don't really know. But my parents were like, what does it say, Danny? What does it say? And I said that the fortune cookie said, calm down, Danny. And like, okay, that's not really a big thing, but later on, reflecting on it, like in recovery, it's like, I always knew that I was a little bit too much. I always knew that I was a little too hyped up, I was a little too excited, I was a little too anxious, I was a little too over the top, and I needed to tone it down. And I had that message down by the time I was 4 years old. And this process for me has not been about blaming my parents or blaming anybody else. What happened to me happened to me. We go through a whole bunch of stuff. And that's not to discount those of us who are, you know, abused and have trauma and so on and this and that, so on and so forth. Those things are serious. But what matters to me is what do I do? You know, I'm the one carrying this years later is what I'm trying to say. So I took that message of calm down, Danny, and it's like, wow, 15 years later, I really like heroin a lot. I really wanted to calm down a lot. I wanted to calm down all the time, and it was a problem for me. And all I cared about was creating the feelings that I thought I was supposed to be having. You know, the way I grew up, it was like, I don't know. I don't know if it's real different from other addicts, and I get nervous about, oh my God, 7 fucking minutes, are you kidding me? Can we wrap this up? Good God. John told me that he was gonna give everyone, he's flipping me off right now, fuck you. He's gonna feed everyone a bunch of espresso and tell them to come here, so I took revenge on him by asking him to introduce me. But then he took revenge by not saying a whole lot, and good God. So the cycle continues. So growing up, you know, my parents weren't well, but they were not well in like sort of an ordinary, you know, way. And it's like, I don't even know if it's important to emphasize that. What I'm saying is what's important is the message I took and what I chose to do with it in my behaviors, how I chose to carry myself. Because for me, the way I interpret things is a lot more important than what happens a lot of the time. Somebody could look at me and smile, and I could say that person is laughing at me. They're in on a joke. They think I'm a sucker. They think I'm a fraud. They're laughing at me. That's my interpretation. I put everything on that. So the messages I took growing up, and again, it's like through doing step work, I come to understand that what matters is my beliefs and how I understand and carry things with me. I remember going to grandparents' house and they would come up to me with they would each have a glass of whiskey and a cigarette, and they'd say, young man, don't ever start smoking or drinking. And I was confused, and I was intrigued. And we'd have dinner together, and grandma would have too much to drink, and she'd pass out into her spaghetti, and my mom would be like, dutifully, would be like, guys, grandma's really tired right now. Let's go in another room. So we have some of these, you know, seeds of addiction and, you know, I don't know how important any of this stuff is. I don't like pacing. What's important for me is that I never felt I was connected to anybody. I never felt anybody understood me. I never felt that anyone else had the same feelings as me. I felt I was alone. I felt I was weird. I felt I was awkward. I felt that everyone else was like in on some sort of joke or some sort of arrangement, or they could figure out how the fuck to do life, and I could not figure that out. I grew up in New York City. We moved to Virginia when I was 11. I did not like it. When I was 14, I moved back to New York, and I commenced using for about 10 years before I got clean. I was on my mission. I thought New York was the promised land, and I had to be up there in order for things to be okay. And that was a sample of me running my own life, all the way, full tilt, was going back up to New York. I don't like how I'm sharing so far, y'all. I want to share that with you. I feel scared. No, it's not bullshit, because I actually don't like how it feels, although my thoughts might not be accurate, so. Yeah, fuck it, bring the feathers. We'll do that. Addiction to me is like a chronic, you know, a state of non-acceptance. Okay, so whatever was going on inside of me, I was not okay with. And, you know, to be honest with you, I blank on a lot of the, like, autobiographical, like, I did this and we moved here when I was this and then I grew up with such and such. I mean, it's kind of like there was feelings. There was big feelings. I didn't know how to handle the feelings. I wanted something that could help me with the feelings, and anything that promised a way to run away from what I was feeling was good news for me. Okay, so I used fantasy. I used anything I could get my hands on. Video games, porn. I thought I was the first kid to ever experience that. You know, fucking wore that one out. So what I'm saying, by the time I used for the first time when I was 14, I was already like at a bottom. I was done. I didn't like life. I didn't like what it was about. I didn't like how it felt. I wanted to check out. I didn't want to be here anymore. And I wasn't suicidal that I remember, but I wanted to be anyone or anything or anywhere but where I was. And I was desperate, and I was hopeless, and I was lost, and I hadn't even used yet. And I was introduced to drugs, and everything changed. And I was one of those that the first time I got high, I found it. This is where I need to be for the rest of my life. You know, there's problems with money and logistics and so on and so forth, but I found my passion. I found what was going to be my thing, and I proceeded to. I wanted to use every drug in every which way and experiment and find. I wanted to control the way that I felt. I wanted to control what I was feeling because I was not okay with it. And I proceeded to use and use and use and use. And I had different bottoms relating to different favorite drugs. And what I learned in Narcotics Anonymous is that it's not about what drug I used, it's about what's driving me to use uncontrollably. So I want to talk about what the disease of addiction is. You know, and it talks about in our basic text, it's a disease of obsession, compulsion, and self-centeredness. And it's a spiritual illness. And I feel to me that, you know, addiction is the self-centeredness, the spiritual core of this disease. 12 minutes, good Lord. Coming up on 13 minutes, okay. I must be vigilant. I'm just a little bit rigid sometimes. So I have this spiritual illness where the core of it is self-centeredness or a spiritual void that makes me feel like something's just a little bit not quite right. I'm not exactly who I should be. I'm not exactly where I should be. Something about this existence isn't quite what it should be. And it'll happen in little ways. I sit down somewhere at a meeting and it's like, man, it'd be nice if I was across the room. You know, it'd be nice if I was talking to her. It'd be nice if I was in this conversation. You ever get out of a meeting and you're in a conversation, but you wanted to be in another one? And you're listening to the other one much more intently than the person that's talking at you or whatever the case. So, spiritual void. I'm not where I should be. I should be somewhere else. And that sounds kind of funny, but that can go all the way up to the level of, like, I don't belong on this fucking earth and I need to die. I need to be gone, nixed, you know. And so that void happens, that discomfort, and I begin to obsess, the mental component, the obsession. I start to have thoughts about, I know what I can do to fix this. I know, I just need to go across the room. And then when I get there, I just need to go to another chair. And when I get there, I need to go to another chair. Or I know what I can do. I need to, once I get to this point, I'll be happy. Or once I use this, I'll be happy. And so there's this obsessive idea that I know how to fix this feeling that I don't like. And then the compulsion happens where it's like it's locked in. And there's no turning back. And I was in the grip of that for a bunch of years. I was in the grip of that, and I did not know it. I did not know I was an addict. And I came to a point of desperation. And I got clean when I was 23. And I've been clean for 12 years. I've been clean and in Narcotics Anonymous for a third of my life. And I'm really fucking grateful about that. I'm really fucking grateful about that. I got free. People told me that I didn't have to be living the way I was living. You know, I went to a treatment center, and that's how I got clean. I want to say this, too. You don't need to go to treatment to get clean. It's okay if you don't go to treatment. It's okay if you do. It's not part of Narcotics Anonymous. That's how I got clean. That was the circumstance in my life that led me to be part of this fellowship that taught me how to live, that is teaching me how to live. And so I became acquainted, like, I moved from New York, I went to this treatment center, I was like, hey, mom and dad, I'm addicted to heroin, what do I do? You know, it's like this big, like, reaching out thing, you know, because I hadn't been connected to my family in so long. I basically ran away from home when I was 14 because I knew better than anybody else, and I knew how to guilt trip my parents, and I knew how to shame them and humiliate them into giving me what I wanted. I always told the story of how big and bad I was. No, it was like, I was this sweet, manipulative kid, and I knew how to push mom and dad's buttons and make them give me what I wanted. And they were helping me to kill myself. And they helped me to get clean, too. At the end of my using, I had sort of revealed this to my parents. I was living on the Lower East Side of New York City, and I was hopeless. I was lost. I was playing in a band. I was playing in a post-punk band. It was very, like, apocalyptic. You know, I thought it was really pretty cool. You know, I was a tortured artist, and I was. God, I was into that stuff. My dad had, there was this situation where, like, and there was miracles all the way, 17 minutes. I can't stop. I'm all in. Fuck. There's no way out. My dad had a situation. He, like, accidentally had sat on his cell phone or something. He accidentally called a guy that he used to work with, like, a decade ago. And they hadn't talked in a long time, so it was like this catch-up, hey, how's it going, so on and so forth. He called this guy named Joe. And so they caught up a little bit, and Joe had 25 years clean in Narcotics Anonymous. This was around the time that I was starting to reach out for help and wanting to get clean. And I was on Joe's radar then, because he found out that my dad had a son that was struggling. And Joe came into my life and wanted to know how I was doing and would hang out with me. And, like, you know, we'd talk and we'd go out to eat and so on and so forth. And I went to treatment, and I got clean, I came out, and Joe was, like, calling me, like, how's it going? And I was like, well, you know, I used again, but, like, I think it'll be okay, and blah, 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 maybe we could go get dinner. And he just, like, he tore me a fucking new, I mean, he just, like, he laid into, I was like, I think it'll be fine. He's like, you're wrong. It's not going to be fine. You don't know what's going to happen if you use. You don't know where you're going to end up. You don't know what you're doing at all. And I was like, why is he being mean to me? But then, I didn't get it. I didn't have any comprehension there was any other, because everything I was doing was right. I didn't have room for any other perspective in my mind. I still think this is weird speaking up here. Just, by the way, slightly neurotic guy here. Obsession, compulsion, pops, yeah. So he would hang out with me for like 4 or 5 hours, and he told me to go to the treatment center again. And I did, and I got clean. And I did what they told me to do, and I moved to a halfway house in Asheville, North Carolina. And again, none of that part, like halfway house, treatment center, not part of NA. That was part of me getting clean, though. That was part of me being introduced to Narcotics Anonymous in Western North Carolina. And that's where I started to learn a new way to live. And like, you know, okay, stop, quit looking at me. I guess y'all are gonna look at me if I'm up here. So I moved to this new town, and miracle, like a big part of my recovery is coincidences and miracles happening, which I believe are part of recovery. That's like breadcrumbs. I mean, the thousands of them have happened in my recovery, and they've never happened before I got clean, because I wasn't looking for them. It's like we get on a certain frequency, a wavelength, to where I'm willing to look at this stuff. I remember I had this sponsor, the first sponsor I had, he was pretty tough on me. He was like, you need to call me every day, you need to go to a meeting every day, and you need to pray every day if you want to stay clean. He didn't tell me what to pray to, he didn't tell me how to do it, but he said that I didn't know how to stay clean, and maybe I could ask something greater than me to help. And so I would pray, and I developed this habit of like, I would walk to work. I was working at a grocery store. When I first got clean, Western North Carolina, they have this grocery store chain called Ingles, Ingles. And I got there, I had like 30 days clean. I was so fucked up, I thought it was a Spanish specialty store called Inglés. And I was like, where am I? Like these lights are, they have a big like yellow, red lettering. And I was like, this is crazy. This looks like downtown Manhattan, okay. And I applied for a job. And they gave me the job, bagging groceries. And I was in there, I was like, look, I haven't used any heroin in like 30 days. And I'm just like, I go to meetings all the time. And they were like, dude, just bag the groceries. Like, go, like deal with the shop, like bag the groceries, bring the shopping carts in. Don't steal any of our shit. Like, don't do anything shady. It's fine. Like, here's your schedule. You can go to meetings. You know, you can leave for meetings. I don't know. The beginning of my recovery, it feels like it was really a magical time. I was doing a second step. I would walk to this store every day from my house, and I would pray, and it seemed like every time I prayed, there would be like a rustling in the trees. You know, and it was like I would talk to God. Or whatever it is that I was connecting to, it was beyond my thinking. And I'd never seen any, I didn't believe in any of that kind of thing. But I would pray and something would happen. There was like a response. And it doesn't matter if it was happening or not. It's that I recognized, I was starting to open my eyes. Like, man, there's this whole universe out here. I had been living in my head. I had been living in how do I want to feel today? What does Dan want to do? And it changed into something different than that. I want to talk about the steps a little bit. Let me back up to this. I was in the treatment center. Another cool thing happened. I was in the treatment center, and this guy was like sharing. He came to speak with us or whatever, and an earthquake happened while he was speaking, and it was a particularly powerful share, and an earthquake happened. Does anyone remember that? It was in 2011. It was in July. It was like kind of a weird thing that happened, and I was like, what the fuck? Like, I was dope sick and earthquakes and, you know, this and that. I get to Asheville. Another weird thing happened. I was around town. I ran into someone I knew from New York City right off the bat. I was like, what are you doing here? Someone I used to kind of hang out with, sort of similar circles. I end up going to her apartment, and we're hanging out, we're talking. And I remember this. Her roommate comes home, and he's got a grocery bag, and it's clinking. And I kind of like freeze, right? I'm like 30, 60 days clean, something like that. And her roommate's like, do you want a beer? And I'm like froze. I almost threw up. I almost threw up, and I don't know what I said to get out of that situation, but I left. I left, and I prayed, and I told people, and it was like my body was saying, please don't do that to me again. Please. You know, I don't know if I'm conveying, like, the desperation that we go through. I mean, I don't share a whole lot about using, because it's about desperation. It's about misery. It's about suffering. My disease, I think this is something we really get wrong. We think this disease is about pleasure, and I want to feel good, and I want pleasure, and it's just too much pleasure-seeking. It's not about seeking pleasure. It's about misery. It's about suffering. My disease tells me that it's going to be about pleasure later when I get the next bag, when I get the next bottle, when I get the next thing. But it's never actually about pleasure, because it's never about this moment. It's always about suffering now, and it's going to be okay later when you get what you're supposed to get. And I promise you, it's coming right around the corner. It's always the next hit. It's a fucking lie. It's a fucking lie. Addiction, using, is not about pleasure. It's about hurting, and it's about being alone. And it's about making as many people suffer as much as I possibly can. It's not about dying. This disease doesn't want to kill me. It wants me to suffer and to spread as much suffering into this world as I possibly can. And recovery is about the opposite of that. And yes, I am going to check my phone because I like to keep a schedule. I forgot my day timer. Oh, my God. There's a lot of things I've learned that have been really important. Like, I hope I'm sharing, like, I care about this stuff. Like, if you're new, is there anyone here that's in their first year of recovery? Of course there is, but hi, welcome. Like, fucking, yes, good. Can I tell you something? I have a lot of problems, but I'm fucking free. And you can be too. You know what I was told when I got clean? You don't ever have to use again, no matter what happens. Ever. Ever. That was the message I got the first 6 months to a year. I didn't need to hear anything else. I had a home group back then, also 5 days a week. This guy would share every time, you never have to use again, no matter what. And I heard it so many times that when I would have a dream about using, in the dream I would go to the meeting and he would share that shit and I'd be like, fuck, I forgot. Gotta get a white tag, you know. You don't ever have to use again, no matter what. And nothing, you know what? Nothing on the face of this fucking planet can make me use ever. You know what the only thing is that can make me use? Me taking a chemical substance and placing it into my body. There's nothing else can make me use. And I gotta be real about that. You know, I think other people that aren't in the program, they see our first step that we're powerless, and they say, oh, these guys don't want to be responsible. They want to be victims. But if you've worked a first step, you know that we're taking responsibility, that we're learning that we don't ever have to use, and that it's on us to not put the drugs in. It's on me to not use today. I have that choice, and you have that choice. You gave me that choice. I never knew it was a choice before. Compulsion is about not knowing that I have a choice. And when I don't recognize the choice, I'm forced to do the same shit that I always did. It's not sane. Being powerless, the first step and the second step are kind of about, like, the steps have changed in what they're about to me, but it's like, we admitted that we're powerless over our addiction, our lives have become unmanageable. First of all, I can't do this alone. If I was gonna translate that step, I cannot live life alone. I don't know how to stay clean. But another thing is, I can't just say that I don't like reality and I'm going to substitute it for some other one. That's like the deepest insanity that I have, is that I don't like this reality, I'm going to just replace it with something else. I can't do that. I'm not God. I'm not free to just decide I don't like this. I don't like what the universe is. I'm going to tweak it to something that Dan favors more than this. That's not possible. Making a decision. In the interim, yeah, I told you, I got a sponsor. I was going to meetings because other people were going to meetings. Look, I didn't know what to do. I didn't come to Narcotics Anonymous like, geez, I think I'll explore getting clean and see what recovery is like. You know, that's not, that may be your story, that's fine, but mine was about desperation and running out of all the energy I had. I could not dope fiend anymore. I couldn't do it. I was used up. I was 23. I was fucking used up. I was done. There was no more of me left. And I couldn't fight it anymore. And so I was at meetings. The treatment center took us to meetings And I was like, I didn't know what was going on. I thought I had one babysitter at the treatment center, and then they took us to a church, and we had other babysitters. I didn't know. But at the church, we were at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I started to hear things. And so I just really got on board with, like, everything they share to do in this program. The third step is me deciding that I'm going to live the NA program as best I can today, choosing this, because we have to do it on purpose. Recovery happens on purpose. It's not going to happen by accident. I'm not going to, like, trip and fall into recovery. And this guy used to share in my home group, you can't coast uphill. I don't think there's any better description of the third step than you can't coast uphill. I have to continue pedaling. I have to continue putting effort on purpose into my recovery. I have to choose it with my free will. Narcotics Anonymous and the 12 steps expands my range of freedom and what my free will is about. Free will is use it or lose it. My disease wants me to not to surrender my free will completely. And Narcotics Anonymous is annoying as fuck because you make me take full responsibility for my freedom of choice. I am condemned to have to deal with the fact that I'm free. So we go on to inventory. I know. I'm not always like this. Sometimes I'm worse. One of the things I want to share about recovery, and like inventory, that's just writing down my side of the story. What do I think happened in my life? Because I'm not going to be right about it. But I can write down my, this is what I believe happened. This is my story. We all have a story. We have a program. We have programming we carry that causes us to behave in certain ways. And I write that all down in an inventory. I think, and I don't really want to just like go straight through the steps, but when I like, I share that with a sponsor, and two of the most, I want to share about some of the more powerful ways that like steps have changed for me. And then I want to just tell you about like what's going on with me today, because that feels important to me too. The fifth step, I share my version of my story of my life with my sponsor. I get another set of eyes on it. And our basic text says one of the scariest things I've ever heard in my life. Everything we know is subject to revision, especially what we know about the truth. Have you ever heard anything that scary? I was at a meeting once, and this guy, he was like, he was getting flustered, and he didn't know how to get the words out, and he's like, everything you know is wrong, okay? And that's kind of what it's like, is that like surrendering these deeply held beliefs. Look, I'll cling with my whole life to a negative belief that hurts me. I would rather, I'd say Dan is a piece of shit. He's a loser. He's a lowlife. He's scum. He'll never amount to anything. And I'll cling to that like it's my best friend. And you can't pry it away from me. And if you try, you're my enemy. Because I'd rather have a belief than surrender a belief and say, I don't really know what the fuck is going on. I would rather have a coherent story about who I am than admit I don't know myself too well. And so the fifth step, my world is upside down. I don't know. I don't have a point of reference. I'm living beyond the expectations that I've held up to this point. And it's disorienting, and it's confusing, and it's strange, and it leads to freedom. Also, I want to say something about the fourth step. It has this line, the more we live the program, the more God seems to put us in positions where issues surface. So I want to say, if your shit's all up in your face, I'd like to congratulate you. You may just be working a program. You might also be fucking up. I don't know. Talk to someone about that. We go through the sixth and seventh steps, and you know, those to me, like, more and more have become more internal, and I don't know how to talk about them. Maybe that means I need some work on them. But what I want to share about is also the amends process, because I think that is more than what we think it is too. When I hold a resentment, it talks about reliving experiences again and again in our minds. Reliving an experience. I hold on to something because it shouldn't have happened that way, and I play it again and again and again and again and again and again, again because I didn't like how it came out. And the ironic thing is that because I didn't like how it came out, I'm going to repeat it over and over again for the rest of my life because I need to set it up again so I can get it right this time. I don't like how she didn't love me. I'm going to find everyone else who doesn't love me too and make her do it right this time. The problem is first I have to find the people that don't love me. First I have to find the people that aren't capable of loving me. And then I end up in pain. And that's why I could move to California and I could start bitching about everyone here is the same and all women are the same and all NA meetings are the same and employers are the same. They're not the same. I'm carrying the same shit with me. I haven't forgiven it. I haven't amended it. I haven't changed what's on the inside. And, you know, these steps lead to freedom. These steps lead to freedom. If I can surrender that, I can be released to actually live in the present moment. And that's what this is about. So the secret is, and this is like in the 11th step. I don't like the going through the steps thing, but I guess that's what I'm doing, kind of. this is about getting into the present moment. The one place my disease tells me I should never go. My disease tells me it's not safe in the present moment. Be anywhere but here. You know, be uncomfortable, go there, shift around, go talk to her, get another job, this. Maybe I should move again. Maybe I should do that. Maybe I should use this. Maybe I should develop this exercise routine. It never tells me to be present because that's where God is. Whatever that may be, connection with myself, this universe, other people. And in the 12th step, this program has turned my life all the way inside out because I used to be hiding who I was. And I still kind of do some of that shit a lot more than I want to. I'm struggling with that this weekend. Let me be real. I don't feel that it's safe for me to be who I am. It's not because of anyone else. It's because of what I carry with me. You know what I mean? I get disappointed in myself for that. But anyway, the 12th step, this is about me being who I am on purpose and that ending up being a good thing for myself and others. You know what I mean? It's like somehow truly being authentically myself is beneficial to other people. It's not more important than anybody else, but it's helpful and it's good and it feels fucking awesome. Because I thought my life was a throwaway. I thought it mattered nothing. It was a mistake. It was trash. I mean, discarded. I really thought this before I got clean. There was nothing to this life. It was a mistake. I remember driving around on this road, eating pill after pill after pill, hoping I got the courage to drive off a fucking bridge. I don't feel that way anymore. Feel my life has meaning and purpose, and it's good that I'm here. And then it can matter to other people. Again, not more, not in a grandiose way, but it matters. We connect. Look, I drove around this camp out, and I saw like five or six people. I brought a new friend with me to the camp out, and I was telling him, this is how I put it, and I think this is true. There's like five or six or seven people here that if I really fucked up and I like killed someone, I would call him and I'd say, what do I do? I would tell them. I'd say, do you have a shovel, man? I think I did something bad. Not on speakerphone, am I? Having somewhere between like 5 and 10 people in my life that I feel I can tell anything to was not in the realm of possibility before I got clean. And I got here yesterday, and I felt so fucking grateful and connected, and I felt that my life, the life we have and share together, who has these kinds of relationships that we can build here? We do. We do. And if you've never been here, you don't know that. Am I running out of time? Because I don't want to go for my phone again. Because y'all are being very shaming about that right now. I was dating someone who's not in the program, and yeah, that's a problem. Kind of like dating someone in the program is a problem. It's like, fuck, man. There's only two problems. There's me getting what I want and me not getting what I want. They're both big problems. But I brought her to some meetings because she had a lot of similar emotional stuff to us, go figure, and I thought it was like, this will rub off on her. She'll maybe make some friends here. She'll connect. She'll be inspired. She reacted poorly to the meetings. And it actually really broke my heart. I mean, this is a really sad thing that she was like crying and she's like, I don't have anything like this. Because she's been through a lot of shit, and she didn't respond to that with uncontrollable drug use. So thank God we have a symptom that can tell us what our problem is. Thank God for uncontrollable drug use. Oh my God. I'm not well. I didn't want y'all to figure out that I'm not well. That's a problem. That's another, yeah, sick as fuck. I remember at early meetings, I saw there was this a meeting schedule went around, someone put their name on it, and they wrote next to it, they wrote, the worst addict. That stuck with me for years. A lot of things have happened in my life that I never thought possible. I got, you know, degrees. That's not, you know, that can happen if you want it to. You know, it meant something to me. The relationships mean more than anything. The connection with my family. I'm going to tell y'all what has happened for me in my life the last 18 months, because it's been intense. About 18 months ago, maybe more like 16, I had a sponsor that was my sponsor for 10 years. And we were close. And he helped me work through a lot of stuff. And he was one of the closest people in my life. And he left the program after a long, long, long time clean. And after that, I broke up with Katie, who I was telling you about. And I loved her more than anyone I've ever been with, but I didn't think it could work. And after that, my brother drove drunk and killed a pedestrian in Los Angeles. He's being sentenced for prison now. And after that, I got a new job and I moved from Williamsburg to Charlottesville, Virginia for a whole new career. And after that, my sister went to jail. And after that, my dad died 2 months ago. It's been a hard year and a half for me. There's been times I've thought, why is it like this? You know, and it's like, I've cried a lot this last year and a half. Narcotics Anonymous has been there with me. I mean, I don't want to turn this into, oh, NA has been there every step of the way. Yes, it fucking has, of course. It always is. Always. I haven't always had the same friends in NA, but I've always had someone to walk with me through what I'm going through. And you know what? It's like people drift apart. It's not personal, but there's always someone that shows up and can walk with me through some dark shit. And who that is changing, and that's fine. You know who came to my dad's funeral? Fucking NA members. About a third of them at the funeral were NA members. He wasn't an NA. He was an old-ass guy that my friends got to know and love because my friends love me. I didn't think I could be loved. I didn't think I was worthy or possible for you, if you knew who I was, to love me. That's why I was so desperate that I was willing to take poison and do anything necessary to get out of what I was feeling. Because I did not think it was fucking okay to be who I was. And I don't care who gave me that message. It's in me now, and I need to do something about it. You know, I don't care if your parents told you that you weren't shit. It's yours now. You have to do something about it, or it'll fucking eat you. I'm sorry, that's how it is. You know, the stuff I carry is the stuff I carry, and the steps say, what do I want to do about this? Do I want to get free or not? What do I want to do with this life? What do you want to do about your problem, and how can we help? I got a lot of different feelings with all these events that I just shared about. What happens when that person that I love, that I was dating, and look, admittedly, my relationship history has been, I don't know the right adjective for it. suspect. I'm beginning to think that, you know, she liked to blame me for stuff, and I like to be blamed for stuff because I think I'm a bad person. So it really meshed together kind of well. And that's putting it too simply. But what happens when she came back into my life and I was trying to reconnect with her, and then my dad died, and then she came to the funeral, and she was there for me, and she was like the fucking MVP and picked up my brother and his wife, and now it's not working again? What happens when I don't understand any of this shit and it doesn't seem to make sense anymore like it used to? What happens when it's not so inspiring anymore for you to tell me to write a fucking gratitude list? Or to go to a meeting, or to keep coming back, or to, well, Dan, I found that surrender, it works when you, like, the fucking rules, all the rules we come up with. I have found that when I do this, I get that. Okay, that's great, but what happens when we're totally lost? All the way outside of our realm of expectations and everything we've ever understood to be true, what the fuck are you gonna do then? It's not about rules. It's not about what we think this stuff means and how I can control it. It's about I have no control. Deeper level of surrender. Yeah, this thing. This. Apparently that, yeah, keep coming back, yes. I have found that I'm just kidding. Yes, that too. It's all fucking true. Oh, my God. Am I out of time yet? Should I tell another story? Oh, I've been speaking for 45 minutes, y'all. This is hostage territory. And if I tell, the other one that came up to me is sad. There's a lot of people die in this process. You guys know that? Everybody dies. By the way, we all will get an opportunity to die and no longer be here. Every single person. We get, like, but it doesn't have to be sad and alone and, like, in a gutter somewhere when we could have been so this or that or the other. And we never got a chance to live and be who we were because we were so tied up trying to run away from who we feared that we were. We have choices about this stuff. This program works. There's a way to get free. It's demonstrated. When we share the message, you know, the message is that any addict can stop using, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. But that's not all we say to each other in meetings. We share our experience, strength, and hope, and it shows that message in the way we live and in what we say. This life in Narcotics Anonymous has been beyond my comprehension. Things are outside of anything I imagine possible. I had a sponsee that killed himself a bunch of years ago. And he was really, a lot of people loved him, including me. And he didn't know how to live with or without drugs, and he killed himself. He resorted to hanging himself. And the last thing I ever said to him is I love you. This was before he did it. I called him because he was going the wrong direction, and I told him, look, dude, I don't think you're doing what you need to be doing. I was scared to do that. He killed himself. And it tore me up bad. And it was like short, but really intense. And a lot of people in my area, we knew him. He was loved, but he couldn't love himself. Didn't think he could. I was at my home group one night, and this guy, my sponsee that killed himself, had been bringing around his fiance. And she would sit there, and she was, like, real sweet and real kind of, you know, prim and friendly and was very, you know, delightful person, but would just sit there. And after he died, one time she showed up to a meeting in my home group. He was dead. Another home group member was out of town because his brother died from an overdose. And I did the key tags, and she came up and got a white key tag. She got a white key tag. I fucking lost it. And then a few years later, I got to give her a black key tag. And I don't understand how this stuff works. Am I going to say that's a good thing? No, I'm not really. Am I going to say it's a bad thing? No, I'm not going to do that either. What happens if there's shit that doesn't fit in any of the categories that I believe to be true? Then I start living. Because before, it was like, before I came to NA, I did not even able to consider that anything I thought could possibly be wrong. I didn't even know that I had thoughts. I thought I just had access to truth. I'm serious. I didn't know I was having thoughts about something. I just thought I was directly saw the truth. Direct access. You know, not arrogant at all or anything like that. And Narcotics Anonymous is like, hey, man, like, Do you have a big old fucking set of lenses in front of your eyes? I don't know. I love this way of life a lot. I love it a lot. I don't know what else to say. I must be out of shit to say. My life is good. It's hurt a lot, but it hasn't always hurt. I've had the greatest joys I've ever had in my life in Narcotics Anonymous. I've had some intense pain too. I love y'all very much. Very fucking much, and I hope you keep coming back and let this program set you free. All right, that's it. Thanks for letting me share.